Chapter 36. In the chapters on Tovar and Cardenas, Fray Marcus and Garces, I have given some idea of the history of the Spanish explorations of the Grand Canyon region. In this chapter, is presented an account of the brave work done by later explorers. Until now, the Grand Canyon and the whole canyon system of the Colorado River is as well known as the course of many a less dangerous stream. Early American trappers. Who can know whether any of those daring souls, the trappers of the earliest days of American history, ever penetrated to the depths of these canyons in their expeditions after the pelts of fur-bearing animals? These men were the true pioneers. They ever kept thrusting the frontier line further forward. As civilization, with people, villages, towns, cultivated lands, advanced westward, still further west pushed the trapper. Civilization was a hindrance to his business. The wild animals he sought fled from the presence of many men. Though the Indian had penetrated more or less to all these secluded regions, the Indian has enough of the reserve of outdoor life not to disturb any of the animals. It is the imperious, self-willed, noisy white man who drives away the shy creatures of the wild. The United States purchases new territory. In 1815, the small nation known as the United States had become eager to grow, and Jefferson had made his memorable purchase of all the territory north of the Red River, the Arkansas and the 42nd parallel, as far as the British boundary or Canadian line, then still unsettled, and the disputed region of Oregon. Lewis and Clark had made their wonderful expedition, and the world, through the publication of their report, knew a little of the immense territory now acquired. In the previous century, the Spaniards had discovered the value of the pelts of the fur-bearing animals of California, and a few venturesome spirits were soon to learn that the western mountains, forests, and rivers abounded in the same profitable game. In his interesting and illuminative American Fur Trade of the Far West, Chittenden has shed a flood of light on these early day operations. Trappers seek riches. Padilla, Kino, Garces, Escalante, and others of the brave Spanish padres had penetrated into some portion of these unknown territories, but they had gone with the vow of poverty upon them. No greed for gold blinded their eyes to the rights of others. A hunger for the salvation of souls was their only hunger, the glitter of the golden harps and crowns in heaven the only glitter that attracted them. But the trappers had a different purpose. They were a different kind of men. Rough and ready, venturesome to the last degree, turbulent as the raging Colorado, imperious in their high-handed dealing with all who stood in their way, they were about to enter the conflict for the sake of gold, and gold is the most remorseless driver, the most soul-destroying master man ever has had. Trappers the primary cause of Indian wars. It has been the trappers who largely have given to us our notions of the American Indians of the West. For they were the first men to come into conflict with them. They were the first to dispute with them about water holes and springs, about heights, about property. Is it necessary to ask what kind of a report such men would bring of any who stood in their way? Is it necessary to know much of human nature to know how these men treated the Indians? The trappers not only began the lucrative fur trade of the West, that laid the foundation for several vast American fortunes, but they also laid the foundation for a series of Indian wars that have cost the United States more lives and treasure than all the furs ever gathered on earth were worth. And not only did they take the furs from the animals they trapped, the agents of the fur companies, whether British or American, took them from the Indians. Read Jim Beckworth's accounts of how he traded with the Indians, and listen to his own comments upon his actions. As D'Lenbaugh vividly says, colon roughshod the trapper broke the wilderness, fathomed its secret places, traversed its trails and passes, marking them with his own blood, and more vividly with that of the natives. The Ashley Fur Camp is established. Early in the last century, the trappers were operating on the headwaters of the Colorado River. Green River Valley was discovered, and in 1822 one of the most brilliant men of the West of that period, General William Henry Ashley, born in Virginia in 1778, went to Missouri in 1802 and in 1820 was its first governor, went into the fur trade with Andrew Henry, an expert trapper. 2 years later, with a band of such men as Henry, Ashley established a camp in Green River Valley, and, with his men, set out on expeditions for furs and pelts. Inscription at Red Canyon. When in June, 1869, Powell and his party were passing through the Fourth Canyon after leaving Green River, now known as Red Canyon, they saw an inscription on one of the huge rocks above the river, done in black letters, sheltered by a slight projection of the rock which acted as a cornice, reading, Ashley 18. .5, the third figure was obscure, and some of the party, read in 1835, some 1855. Ashley expedition unsuccessful. It should have been read 1825. Powell was not familiar with the history of the fur traders. Ashley was an unknown name to him, but as Chittenden has so vividly pointed out, he, in his way, left his impress upon our Western civilization as strongly as did Powell. Would that it had been as nobly, as grandly beneficent. Ashley fitted up a trapping expedition to go down Green River, in spite of its known dangers, and, expecting to find beaver in plenty, took but little provisions along with them. At first they did fairly well. Then, as the canyons narrowed, to their horror and distress, as well as surprise, for they had kept none of the meat of the beavers they had killed, the animals ceased to appear, and starvation stared them in the face. For 6 days they were without food. The precipitous walls of the canyon forbade escape, and at length they became so demoralized that Beckworth declares they actually proposed to cast lots as to which should be killed to make food for the others. This fearful proposition so horrified Ashley that he begged them to hold out a while longer, and to their joy they soon emerged from the canyon, possibly at a place known as Brown's Hole, where Provo, an experienced trapper, had his camp. From here they abandoned the canyon expedition, and doubtless returned with Provo to Salt Lake. Powell named the falls near where Ashley left his name Ashley Falls. There is every reason to assume that other trappers attempted the passage of the canyon, for Powell found a bake oven, several tin plates, and part of a boot in Loder Canyon, which he imagined were Ashley's. But, as we have seen, Ashley never went down so far. Other unsuccessful trappers. In his excellent Romance of the Colorado River, Delenbaugh recites at length, from their own narratives largely, the adventures of several trappers and others, whose experiences are connected with the Colorado River, the Paddies, Jedediah Smith, Kit Carson, William Wolfskill, Farnham, Fremont, Lieutenant Derby, Captain Johnson, and others, who, however, never came actually into the Grand Canyon region. Hence I shall make no further reference to them here. My reason for giving so much space to Ashley has been merely to offer a sample of the kind of experiences the trappers of the early days met with in trying to solve the problem of the canyons of the Colorado River. Lieutenant Ives' expedition. Lieutenant Ives' expedition, however, reached into the very heart of this country. He visited the Havasupais in their canyon, also the Wallapais, and traversed the weary miles across the desert to the villages of the Hopi. Steamboats had plied up and down the Colorado River from the Gulf of California as far as Fort Yuma, near where the present railroad bridge crosses the stream, but Ives was instructed by the War Department to explore the river further up, in order to determine whether the military posts of New Mexico and Utah could be reached, and their supplies transported by the Colorado. Instead of calling upon Captain Johnson and chartering his steamboat, the Colorado, Ives ordered his steamer constructed in Philadelphia, and shipped in sections via the Isthmus of Panama to San Francisco, and thence around Cape Lucas into the Gulf of California, to the mouth of the Colorado River. Yet he was able to report, doubtless with a clear conscience, that Johnson's company is unable to spare a boat, except for a compensation beyond the limits of the appropriation. Ives report and accompanying pictures. Ives report is a most interesting document, and the pictures that accompany it, made by Molossin and Eglefstein, especially those of the latter artist, are wonderful in their imaginative qualities. They are no more like the Grand Canyon than are the visions of Dore, yet they afford a good idea of the impression its vastness and sublimity made upon an artistic mind. Starts up the river. Ives ascended the river, passing Johnson on the way in the Moha Valley, a few miles above the Needles. The latter had gone to ferry Lieutenant Beale and his outfit across the river. So in reality he was ahead of Ives, for he entered the Black Canyon to the highest point attainable by steamers before Ives did, and thus got the better of the man who had refused to hire him and his steamer. Journey is abandoned. But Ives went on, as if Johnson had never existed, discovered what was already known, viz. That the river is flanked by walls many hundreds of feet in height, rising perpendicularly out of the water, the Colorado emerging from the bowels of the range, and then struck a sunken rock, and had to give up in disgust. Returns east across country. Sending his vessel, the Explorer, back to Fort Yuma under the command of Robinson, its efficient captain, the gallant lieutenant now struck out across country, having received new supplies and his pack train. Under the guidance of an intelligent Mohave Indian, Iratiba, they reached Diamond Creek, and there not only came in contact with the Wallapais, but for the first time saw the Big Canyon, as they called the Grand Canyon. He then pushed on east, entered the Vassipai Cataract Canyon, visited the Indians there, then made a wide detour to examine the San Francisco Peaks, struck east again, crossed the Little Colorado, and reached the province of Tusayan, where dwell the Hoppus. After a short visit there, he crossed south and east to Fort Defiance, and finally returned east with his report. When the Civil War broke out, Ives joined the Confederate forces, and was killed in one of the battles. Ives' prediction. As an evidence of the folly of making predictions in regard to what the future has in store for any region, let me quote one paragraph from Ives which always has amused me. This region can be approached only from the south, and after entering it there is nothing to do but to leave. Ours has been the first, and will doubtless be the last party of whites, to visit this profitless locality. Yet Ives enjoyed the canyon, and wrote some truly eloquent descriptions of it. How surprised he would be, could he come back now, approach it from the north, cross the river in a steel cage, and find at El Tovar such an hotel as even the city of Washington never surpassed in Ives' day. Then, taking the Grand Canyon Railway, he could speed to Williams, and in 24 hours reach the Pacific, or in 4 days the Atlantic. We march forward with great strides in these days. Powell's preparations for his life work. Even at the time of his writing, 1858, John Wesley Powell was being prepared to bring Ives' words to naught. Born March 24, 1834 at Mount Morris, Livingston County, New York, he found himself in 1858 at Wheaton, Illinois, engaged in making a conchological collection for the Illinois State Natural History Society. While engaged in this work, he also secured collections in botany, zoology, and mineralogy. His mind now opened to perceive that all these sciences were related to the greater science of geology, and thenceforward he declared that this should become his life work. Experiences in Civil War. During the Civil War, he fought with bravery and honor, losing an arm at the Battle of Shiloh, April 6, 1862. When Sherman began his march to the sea, Powell was given command of 20 batteries of artillery. He served on the staff of General Thomas at the Battle of Nashville, and was mustered out in the early summer of 1865. Even during these exciting years, his beloved science not only never lost its attraction for him, but he utilized every possible opportunity to add to his knowledge. He made a collection of fossils unearthed in the digging of the Vicksburg trenches, and from the Mississippi swamp scattered land and river shells. In Illinois, while on detached service, Moses engaged his attention, and he was indefatigable in studying the geology of the region through which his section of the Army passed. Begins geological explorations in Colorado. After the war, he declined a lucrative political office to take the chair of geology in the struggling Wesleyan University of Bloomington, Illinois. He had married his cousin, Emma Dean, in 1862, and, after a glimpse of the country in 1867, he took her and a party that he had organized to make geological explorations in Colorado. This was the beginning of his work that ultimately wrested the secrets from the mysterious canyons of the Colorado River. This preliminary work led him on, as it were, to the greater work, and in 1869 on May 24th with four boats, the Emma Dean, Kitty Clyde's sister, Maid of the Canyon, a no name, and nine companions, John C. Summer, William H. Dunn, Walter H. Powell, G. Y. Bradley, O. G. Howland, Seneca Howland, Frank Goodman, William R. Hawkins, and Andres Hall, he set forth from Green River City. The simple records of that trip, and a later one made in 1871-1873 in which Frederick S. DeLenbaugh, the author of The Romance of the Colorado River, was engaged, read like a romance. A condensation of them is but an aggravation. No one interested in the canyon should neglect to read them, and I am now arranging to republish Powell's original monograph, together with his monumental work on the canyons of the Colorado, the plates of which I purchased at his death for this purpose. Powell's first expedition. In the first expedition, the party was from May 24 to August 30 passing through the canyon system, from Green River City to the mouth of the Rio Virgin. On the 1st of September, four of the men, with a small supply of provisions, resumed their journey on the river to Fort Mohave, while Powell and his brother returned to civilization by way of Salt Lake City. Second expedition. Though Chapter 9 of Powell's report, as published by the government, speaks of the continuation of the explorations of the canyon, and gives an account of the studies made in and around the region of the Virgin River, and Chapter 10 contains Professor A.H. Thompson's report on a trip to the mouth of the Dirty Devil River, there is nothing in the volume that suggests the magnitude of the second trip through the canyon. This great omission Mr. DeLenbaugh supplies in his complete narrative before referred to. Powell's work on the canyon completed. This time three boats started, the Emma Dean, Nellie Powell, and Canyon Sita, manned by S5. Jones, J. K. Hilliers, F.S. DeLenbaugh, A. H. Thompson, J. F. Stewart, F. M. Bishop, F.C. A. Richardson, E. O. Beeman, W. C. Powell, and A. J. Hatton, with Major J. W. Powell, of course, as leader and director. The start was made from Green River City, Wyoming, as before, and the date was May 22, 1871. On the 3rd of September, the mouth of Kanab Canyon was reached, where, on account of high water, the trip for the time being was abandoned. The topographical work of the survey of the surrounding country was continued through to the winter of 1873, when the maps were completed, and Powell's great work on the canyons and tributary country practically brought to a close. Wheeler's expedition in 1871. Another interesting Colorado River expedition was that of Captain G.M. Wheeler, made in the fall of 1871. It was doubtless an offset to that of Major Powell, as in those early days there were three separate geographical surveys in the field, working independently and without common guidance. Hence it was natural that there should have been some degree of rivalry. Captain Wheeler started up the Colorado River from Camp Mohave in three boats that had been specially made in San Francisco, and with a barge loaned by the commanding officer at the fort, Dr. G. K. Gilbert was the geologist of the party. From September 16 to October 20 they had a difficult, arduous and occasionally thrilling journey, reaching the mouth of Diamond Creek at a later date. Diamond Creek is a point on the canyon which used to be largely visited. It is reached from Peach Springs, but the scenery is far less impressive than at any of the more accessible points described in this book. Brown's unsuccessful expedition. 17 years after Powell, Frank M. Brown, a Denver capitalist, determined to survey the canyons with the purpose of building a railway through them to the Gulf of California. The main start was made May 25, 1889 from the Rio Grande Western's tracks across the Green River, with six boats and 16 men. It was a disastrous expedition. Brown himself lost his life at Soap Creek Rapids, some 15 miles below Lee's Ferry, and 4 days later two others were drowned in Marble Canyon. The expedition was then abandoned, the remnant of the party climbing the canyon walls, and finding their way back to civilization assisted by the kindly owner of a cattle ranch. Stanton's boats travel through the whole canyon system. In November of the same year, however, Robert Brewster Stanton, Brown's engineer, observing precautions that Brown had so unfortunately neglected, prepared to continue the exploration. He had his boats hauled on wagons to the mouth of Crescent Creek near Fremont River, to avoid a repetition of the experiences in Cataract Canyon, and a good start was made. The party ate Christmas dinner at Lee's Ferry, and a few days later, slightly below where Brown lost his life, the photographer of the expedition fell from a ledge and broke his leg. With incredible labor, the unfortunate man was got out of the canyon, 4 miles in distance and 1,700 feet in altitude, on an improvised stretcher, and then taken in a wagon which Stanton had fetched from Lee's Ferry. The party then went on, entered the Grand Canyon, and reached Diamond Creek March 1, where they remained 10 days recuperating. The last dash was then made in safety. The boats left the canyon March 17. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.